My name is Justin Smith, and I'm a professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science here at Paris 7. And I have a surprising amount of interest in things that also interest Camille, and we were surprised when we were talking to learn that. In particular, I've done most of my scholarly work on Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the 17th century German philosopher, who is one of the kind of structuring figures for this exhibition. Four walls each represent a different kind of fundamental principle of the philosophy of Leibniz, and we'll talk about those in just a moment. So that was an immediate point of contact and pleasant surprise when I learned from Camille Roux that that she was drawing artistic inspiration from him. Now, my particular work, and I won't talk too much about my actual work on Leibniz concerns theories of the what you could call, broadly speaking, the order and structure of the natural world. So it's history of philosophy, but it's history of philosophy as history of science, because of course the split had not yet occurred. Philosophy was an activity that included natural philosophy in the 17th century, which is what we call today science. Right? But that's all very new. That's yesterday, relatively speaking. So I'm interested, I have been interested in a long time, in theories of the structure of the natural world, in particular what was taken to be the hardest case of the study of natural structure, namely the structure of biological entities, right? Without any knowledge of DNA or even cell structure, people were left to speculate about how it could possibly happen that something as evidently infinitely complex as an organic being could ever take shape. And also, the question was frequently addressed to what extent the living world can be easily demarcated from the non-living world, whether the same sort of explanation can be extended throughout the non-living and the living world, or whether there are different principles in the one case as in the other. And then, of course, once you open up the possibility of different principles in different cases, you have the question of where the boundary is, where the frontier between the two is. And curiously, and another happy coincidence for the theme of today's talk and the theme of the entire Fête de la Science, is that the most common candidate for a boundary entity in natural philosophical debates was crystals, right? Can we account for crystals without appeal to the kind of vital principles that underlie the emergence of organic structure or not? That was the big question. And so when I learned that not only was my task today to talk about this exhibition, which is imbued with so many things I already cared about, but also we had to somehow try to tie in crystals, I thought, perfect. I mean, this is just another confirmation of the truth of Leibnizian philosophy that Camille did not mention, namely pre-established harmony. So you might have already read that there are the walls are organized according to different principles, each of which is drawn loosely from the philosophy of Leibniz, not just the philosophy of Leibniz, but also what you can call les âges de l'homme, the ages of man, and also there are other numerous other theoretical concerns and ambitions that inform each of the sections of the exhibition, as I understand it. And what I think is really striking about Camille Henrot's work is that there's nothing simply fortuitous or just placed somewhere without thought. The more you look at anything and where it's placed and what it is, the more you can discern the intense and deep thought that went into placing it right there. And of course, this is an avowedly subjective process of thought that makes it something that might remain private to the person who created it, but nonetheless, you can at least convince yourself that there is a meaning for why the object is there and not elsewhere. For example, Le Monde is almost certainly not just Le Monde, as in the title of a newspaper, but also that profoundly important philosophical concept of world, right? Just an example that jumps out at me right now. Now, the four principles, maybe I'll work backwards, because again, in many cases, except for the wall that I really want to talk about most, there's a mere loose inspiration. So over here we have the principle of the of what Camille is calling the principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which in Leibniz is something like the view that if any two things have all properties in common, then those two things are not two things but one thing. That is to say that you can't individuate things on the basis of merely external denominations or properties that come only from outside of the things in question. So how that relates precisely to this wall, I will leave it to you to figure out. Now, this wall, which is the wall of the age of man, that is maturity or adulthood, is the wall of the principle of sufficient reason, which is kind of, if we interpret it in the narrow sense in Leibniz's philosophy, the principle that says that there is nothing without a reason, nothing happens except if there's an underlying rationality to it. And of course, in Latin, the language Leibniz was writing in, reason is ratio, which has a geometrical notion, a geometrical importance as well, which is also significant for things like the measuring of the polyhedric shape of crystals, which we'll get back to soon enough. Now, if you just look over at that wall, because again, this is the wall I care about most and that I'm going to focus on eventually. If you just look over at that wall, first, it's the principle of being, by which I think Camille Henrot means the principle of identity, which is to say that everything either is or is not the thing it is, and we can also similarly reflect on how that's related to the coming into being or birth of babies and things that come out of eggs. But again, what I really want to focus on is this particular wall, and in fact on one particular specimen on this wall, namely the pangolin skin, or I shouldn't call it a skin, the pangolin hide, maybe? Cluster of scales. We'll get back to that. But now, the law of continuity in Leibniz's philosophy is very hard to summarize. I don't want to go into it in much detail. But in a way, again, if you know, I just said that over here, the principle of sufficient reason is the supreme expression of the rationalist philosophy, and also, therefore, the idea that nature is, as a whole, an intricate order. There's nothing disordered about it. Over here, as you can see, and as Camille clearly planned, there is some kind of increasing disorder. Things get messy, start looking like a teenager's bedroom, and that is somehow supposed to be an expression of something having to do with the law of continuity. Well, what is the law of continuity? This is related to a lot of debates in kind of the fundamental philosophy of mathematics in the 17th century. The question whether, given any chunk of matter, you can divide it down literally ad infinitum, or whether you get to some fundamental chunks. Aristotle, long before Leibniz, had said that matter is not a continuum, it doesn't express mathematical continuity, because the divisions in it are always there, are not always there prior to being made. So matter for Aristotle is some kind of potential continuum, right? Leibniz's great innovation was to say that no, matter is actually infinitely divided already into actually infinitely many parts. So matter is not, for Leibniz, strictly speaking, a mathematical continuum. The only continua for Leibniz are things like geometrical lines or the series of real numbers, that is including decimal points, mathematical and therefore ideal entities, whereas real-worldly entities are not actually infinitely divisible as a continuum must be, but rather actually infinitely divided, right? Now that's a minor distinction, and this, in some respects, and it all emerges out of reflection on what the law of continuity must be. It has implications for Leibniz's philosophy, among them the view that between any two kinds of thing, there must be another kind of thing, which meant for him, rather surprisingly, that there is, strictly speaking, no such thing as a fixed natural kind, like an animal species, like a shark or a tiger or a meerkat, or even a pangolin. Rather, between any two individual things, including between any two individual meerkats, there will be infinitely many gradations of kindhood, right? That's an implication of the law of continuity. It seems implausible, especially given the context of modern biological science, but there were compelling rationalistic reasons to think it in the 17th century. Now, I began by saying that there was a lot of debate about the nature of the structure of the world, whether one could make a firm division between the structure of organic bodies on the one hand and the structure of what we think of as inanimate nature on the other. Leibniz was what you could call a pan-organicist. He supposed that in the end, everything, including bricks and water and planets and so on, has an organic structure. For him, organic simply means mechanical ad infinitum, or that is to say, something that is ordered all the way down without end, right? Something that has no lower limit to its order. That's what an organism is. So an organism isn't contrasted with mechanism, it's rather a special class of mechanism for Leibniz. Now, for this reason, there is, in an important respect, no fundamental difference between, again, the body of an animal and, for example, a crystal, or even something that's relatively unstructured like cheese or a brick or something like that, right? However, there's another respect in which any given chunk of the inanimate world will not itself be an ideal representative of the organic structure that, that he thinks characterizes the whole world. Now, a lot of debate in the 1690s in particular around the origins of fossils was raging. This goes back also to Leonardo's speculations several decades earlier, that is Leonardo da Vinci, speculation several decades earlier on the origins of seashells that were discovered in the high mountains of the Alps. What were they doing there? Some people said they're tricks of the devil to make you think that the world was once radically different than it is. Some people said, no, these are left over from the flood. Some people had a more sophisticated theory that, that said that these are lusus naturae, games of nature. So nature spontaneously producing what looks like organic form because she's kind of misfiring or putting organic form in the wrong place. So if she puts it into sludge or slime in a creek or a pond, then it can generate into a proper animal. If she zaps it into quartz, then the animal can't grow, and instead it just gets like a frozen skeleton in the middle of a big rock, and that's what a fossil is, right? Leibniz is one of the first in a treatise of 1693 that we call the Proto-Gaia, or the early Earth, to give an account of fossils as fossils. It's a work of paleontology. And one thing that comes out of this is this argument from something like the law of continuity that we can know that, say, fossilized scales or fossilized bone really are fossils, that is to say, vestiges or traces of once living animals, because the more you look, the more detail you get, right? Whereas you would expect the opposite with, and he mentions cases of Virgin Mary's and even Martin Luther's in the Lutheran parts of Germany, where people are claiming to see, you know, see the face of a weeping Mary in the side of a rock. With those, you need to project your imagination, and the closer you get and the brighter the light you shine on it, the more you will be assured that your imagination was doing a lot of the work in making this face of a rock come out as a Virgin Mary. Whereas in the case of fossils, the more you shut your imagination off, the more the animal nature of the thing comes out at you, right? So that's how you can know when you're dealing with a vestige and when you're dealing with the work of the imagination. And here we have a really rather fascinating, I think, later trajectory in the history of aesthetics, particularly in German Romantic idealism, authors like Schiller, who are writing about the role of the imagination in art as opposed to science, which is supposedly the, you know, focus on the way the world really is rather than on the way your mind makes or your imagination makes the world out to be. So now, one of the issues that comes up again and again, okay, we know that fossils are traces because the more we look, the more order we see. What about crystals? What are crystals? Now, Leibniz insists that you don't need what he would refer to as a plastic nature, which is to say an immaterial vital principle of development in order to explain crystallogenesis. Why not? Well, because crystals, the more we look, turn out to be simple repetitions of ordinary patterns of known geometrical figures, right? That can be analyzed down to a certain point, and then we can say we've come to the end of the order in virtue of which this crystal is a crystal. Let me just read to you this nice passage. I know I said I'd do half and half, half English, half French, but once I start speaking English, it's hard to shut it off. But so here's Leibniz writing in 1693. Je vois d'ordinaire que plus on est attentif à observer la nature, plus on est familier avec ses phénomènes, et que les hommes les plus habiles croient à juste titre que les dépouilles des animaux et les débris de divers autres corps ont été submergés et qu'ils ne se laissent pas aisément persuader que des corps organiques sans antécédents, sans destination, sans germe, soient nés en dehors de toutes les lois de la nature, par je ne sais quelle force plastique, la nature plastique que je viens de mentionner, au sein du limon ou de la pierre, matrice inerte. Et je voulais mentionner entre parenthèses qu'au XVIIe siècle, matrice était un synonyme de utérus. Hein, et donc la question ici, il mentionne l'idée de matrice parce que la question était précisément si on doit considérer que les gemmes ou les minéraux sont générés de la même façon que les êtres vivants. Voilà. Car il ne s'agit point ici de certains corps radiés et de ces polygones réguliers que présentent les cristaux, le grenat et les autres gemmes et fleurs, ainsi que divers autres minéraux, non plus que des figures retracées par la neige hexagone. Et je vais m'arrêter là avec la question de la neige, parce que c'est une question à laquelle Kant va retourner après. So basically, there's the idea that you can draw the line at crystals because they are just ordinary repetitions of familiar polyhedrons and other figures like that. Now, there's a related problem, though, which is that biological entities seem to be to partake, so to speak, of the geological world to a certain extent. For example, some of the growth and development of biological entities involves processes like calcination, like the growing of nails and so on. And this kind of overlap is particularly evident in the case of a few types of biological growth that have for a long time been also of aesthetic interest. And this is why I was so struck to see the pangolin hide on the wall of the law of continuity. So pangolins are interesting creatures. I don't know if you know much about them. This is a specimen from the Museum d'Histoire Naturelle, Museum National d'Histoire Naturelle, down the street at the Jardin des Plantes. And they are, this particular one is from India. They have a huge habitat in Central Africa, India, and the East Indies, Indonesia, and elsewhere. But this is a particular Indian species of pangolin. They're not the only mammals with scales, but they're certainly remarkably scaly mammals. And for whatever reason, this sounds like a value judgment to me, but evolutionary biology considers scales to be a primitive feature of mammals. They're only there on the mammals that manifest the most of our very archaic reptilian ancestry, and so pangolins are often seen as, let's say, their cultural life in human cultures where pangolins are found. They're seen as kind of peculiar, perverse, liminal, and so on. And in fact, I think Camille Henrot surely knows this work. Mary Douglas, the British anthropologist, has written a lot about pangolin cults in Central Africa that are and what she has to say about them is particularly interesting. I don't want to talk about all of that. I just wanted to mention again how significant specimens like the pangolin scale are in a context where people are trying to find the dividing line between those things such as crystals, which don't need to be explained in terms of infinite organic structure or in terms of plastic natures that are, again, vital immaterial principles of development. On the one hand, that sort of entity, and on the other hand, truly organic entities like pangolins. Another lovely specimen that I wish Camille could have brought over here that is on display in the Galerie d'Anatomie Comparée at the Jardin des Plantes is of the shell of a glyptodont, which is kind of a giant South American armadillo that went extinct at the end of the Pleistocene, so 11,000 years ago or so, and its shell is formed by what they call scutes. I think it's the same word in French, les scutes, which is just kind of repetitions of geometric excrescences, right? And so you see, and apparently the South American Patagonian natives would find abandoned glyptodont shells and hide under them during storms or to hide from megatheria and other Pleistocene beasts. And so they were using these as shelters. So they're geometric repetitions of hexagons that people can live under. And this really pushes the limit of the question of what is organic and what is crystalline in nature, again, in the sense that I've already described, a special sense of the crystalline. And debates about this continue into the 18th century. I've cited this wonderful text that I won't read here, but Louis Bourguet, who writes in 1729 a treatise called Lettres philosophiques sur la formation des sels et des cristaux. So philosophical letters on crystals. This is a sort of topic that we don't think of as philosophical anymore, but voila, there's a text of 1729 to prove it. And it continues on into the tremendously influential work of Kant from the end of the 18th century, the Critique of Judgment, or what is usually translated into French as the Critique de la Faculté de Juger. And there, Kant was preoccupied with two things that are tremendously relevant to everything we've been talking about and everything around us here, and that are also relevant to the very idea that there might be some reason to go to an art exhibit in connection with something that's the fête de la science. What is the connection? What is the relevance? Well, in Kant's Critique of Judgment, the concern is to understand those domains of thinking in which human beings engage, in which we cannot come to firm, shared, objective conclusions. And in this respect, he saw judgments about art as of a pair with judgments about nature seen not as a kind of an inert object of science in the sense that we understand it today, but rather nature seen as a teleological order. By teleological, I mean something that that is directed towards ends, right? Now, for Kant, it was evident, for reasons that clearly come from having read Leibniz and Bourdieu and others, that it is impossible, so he said, to look at a plant or an animal, including presumably also a pangolin, and to not make an inference of purposiveness, to not suppose that this thing is there for some reason or other. And a lot of his argument has to do with the observation that there are, among natural beings, many entities, like seashells, like colored parrot feathers and so on, that that we cannot look at without making aesthetic judgments of the sort, this is beautiful, right? Now, Kant as well rejected the idea that crystals are explicable in the same terms or require the same sort of explication. And it's in this connection that he famously says, a snowflake has no soul. Right? What does it mean to say a snowflake has no soul? It just means you don't need to suppose that there's something inside there giving it the appearance of structure that it has. The structure it has, again, is just a result of the way the parts arrange themselves, right? So snowflakes don't need a soul. And that's in the first long quote I gave you. But this seems to contrast with la beauté des fleurs, des plumes, d'oiseaux, des coquillages, and so on, where Kant didn't write in French. This is a translation. Where you look at it and you can't help but suppose that there's purposiveness behind these emerging structures. And so he goes on to say, and this is probably one of the most famous lines of the Critique of Judgment, that there will never be a Newton for the blade of grass. Cela est si certain que l'on peut dire hardiment qu'il est absurde pour les hommes de former un tel dessin ou d'espérer qu'il surgira un jour quelque Newton qui pourrait faire comprendre ne serait-ce que la production d'un brin d'herbe d'après des lois naturelles qu'aucune intention n'a ordonné. So Newton is the guy who made inanimate nature make sense. He explained it all with the principles of mathematical physics in the Principia Mathematica of 1686, I think. That sort of rigorous explanation will never be available for even a mere blade of grass, so Kant said in 1790. Now, arguably, he was just wrong. You just had to wait, and this is what Watson and Crick gave us with the double helix in the mid-20th century. And, you know, it was just making premature predictions. But in any case, what I'm trying to get across is that there's this intense preoccupation over a long period with the problem of the limits of natural or of the explicability of natural order. And there was in particular widespread perception both of an important boundary somewhere of explicability, and this was a boundary that that seemed to be called into question with the strange kind of liminal entities like scales that seemed to be the result of organic growth and yet seemed to cross over into other domains. But more importantly, what I want to emphasize is how these reflections back then were connected to emerging reflections on the idea of the aesthetic, which is to say that which is, the aesthetic is a difficult notion. The term was coined in the 1740s, maybe 1730s, by Alexander Baumgarten in a treatise called Aesthetica, and it simply means the theory of sensation, right? When you go to the dentist, you get anesthetic. How is that connected to the aesthetic? It's the negation of the aesthetic, but in a very different sense. Now, what we've retained in the notion of aesthetics is the aesthetic as perception, in particular, of particular kinds of object, namely art objects, or also a special category, a certain kind of perception of sunsets and mountains and things like that. So in that respect, the natural and the aesthetic have always been interwoven, and I think that, you know, beyond the fact that Camille Henrot is taking inspiration from Leibniz for the structure of this particular exhibition, what her work is doing is really dwelling intensively on this, on the nature of this unity between investigation of nature and artistic creation. And this is a unity that I think was self-evident in the 17th and 18th centuries, that was even evident in the conception of science in figures like Goethe in Germany, but that somehow got lost, I don't know when, in the 19th century, with the rise of positivism, and now even more with the rise of the kind of industrial grant structure that has science rigorously pegged to money-making endeavors. So I think what this kind of work can do is really remind us that artistic creation and scientific research are twins, so to speak, and I think that comes out even in the choice of particular objects in this very very well-structured exhibit like the pangolin hide. I'll stop there, so thank you. I'm happy to have answer questions, discussion en français ou en anglais. Je suis désolé d'avoir parlé anglais dès le début, mais comme je l'ai dit, c'est difficile de changer entre les deux langues.
I was quite interested in just something about how the work was fabricated and some of these, obviously there are lots of found objects, lots of the artist fabrications, and some of them look like they've got a lot of history to them.
Sure.
They almost look like they've been adapted, actually.
Yeah.
Well, definitely in some cases, but I was wondering if there's one approach to all of them, or is it just a complete mixture throughout?
I mean, it seems like a real, like I said, I mean, I can't get, I had a few of the objects explained to me and their meaning within this particular context. But in most cases, I'm just guessing what Camille was thinking when she put some particular object in its particular place. You know, again, I think that everything is thoroughly thought out, right? That there's nothing that is just put somewhere without reflection.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think you articulated this very well. I mean, there are personal objects here, a real mixture of registers of both, you know, high aesthetic and junky, right? And they're put together in a very obvious way, but it's just I think left to us to speculate. I think I noticed the Leibniz cakes, among other things.
You would.
Yeah. Right.
The way you characterize it as a kind of problematic of the way that knowledge is created, like the different kinds of knowledge you get from art and from science, is, I think, it's a nice reading of it.
Yeah.
Thank
you. I mean, I was, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot with, you and I were talking about Peter Galison, who was here a few days ago giving a talk at Paris 7, and he's an important American historian of science who is also a filmmaker and an installation artist. And, you know, one point that he makes is that, you know, scientists tend to hate the imagination. And this goes way back, right? They're wary of the imagination because they think that the imagination, is the source of fictions only, of fancies, as they used to say. And science wants to get at the truth, and so the imperative then is, you know, shut up and calculate, and that will tell you how the world actually is, as opposed to what your fancy tells you it is. But in fact, scientists are creating images all over the place with their representations. It's just that they don't call these works of the imagination, they call them models, right? But what often happens is that they just go totally crazy with models that they don't even realize are more fantastical than what artists are making. Like, for example, I mean, this isn't my example, but this is one that often comes up, is string theory. Close your eyes and picture string theory. What do you picture? You picture a bunch of strings hanging out in the middle of deep dark space or something like that, like literal strings. And of course, that's not what string theory is. But the problem is that the scientists themselves seem to have been so captured by these images that they made up this whole program that is now starting to appear like a dead end, right? And so the point of view of someone like Galison is like, look, if you let actual creative people, like people who have some stake in being interestingly creative, like artists, for example, if you acknowledge the relevance of what they're doing for the scientific endeavor as a whole, then they might actually be able to help you come up with better imaginings, right, or better models, right? So in that respect, I'm inclined to see Camille Henrot's work as actually rather similar, though starting from a different place, starting from art instead of science, as what someone like Peter Galison is doing. And that I think is very significant because, you know, there's obviously a shakeup that's occurring in the structure of universities, in the structure of research funding and so on, that I think is forcing us to rethink these old divisions that we've created between art and science. Divisions that are old but not originary. You know, they're not, they didn't used to be there, right? And so.
So I'm kind of an analogy there between the division between the organic and the inorganic as well. Like
yeah.
You were describing.
Sure.
As a kind
sure.
of, they're like non-aesthetic and aesthetic realms somehow.
Sure, sure, sure.
Masculine and feminine.
Yeah, sure, sure. I mean, well, one thing is, you know, there's been one of the most damaging effects of the kind of institutionalization of science over the past century and a half has been the utter exaltation of physics as, you know, the real deal, right? And people talk about physics envy within the sciences. And from that perspective, biology starts to be seen as almost a kind of humanity in its own right, right? One of the humanities, I mean. And it's seen as soft and wet and therefore somehow downgraded. And in fact, if you look at something like Kant's Critique of Judgment, indeed, it's biology that's going to give you the point of contact between the arts and the order of nature, right? Now, of course, you can say, well, yeah, but, you know, planets are beautiful too. It's all beautiful, so why is it biology that's the point of contact? You know, it's just perhaps a historical fact or a curiosity of the Western European tradition that aesthetic reflection has almost always been focused either on objects, on creations of, that people come up with, or on what are strictly speaking biological entities. Pas d'autres questions? Alors, merci beaucoup d'être venu.
Merci.
Merci à vous.